the question was asked when we read the Nevi'im, so what capacity or responsibility do we have to interpret the Nevi'im and see how they play out in our lives today? So the question is a valid one for many reasons. Firstly, Chazal tell us that only prophecies that have an eternal message were written down. So obviously the Nevi'im have a message for us today. So that's one important point. Secondly, you see, the Navi prophesied about things that hadn't yet happened, so certainly seems like it's going to happen, like the Rambam says. The flip side of it is that we don't know when a prophecy is going to happen, and we don't know even the exact interpretation of the prophecies. The commentaries generally understand that when Chazal say that the Nevi'im have an eternal message, what it means is, on the moral level, on the tzipita lishua, the anticipation of redemption, but to say specifically, I can work off the prophets and understand how it's going to play itself out, and working off the prophets, I could look at Syria and say, this is the validation of that prophecy, this is the realization of that prophecy, I don't think we can do that. The Nevi'im themselves weren't always certain when they saw things play themselves out, whether this is the prophecy they had prophesied. You see, Yirmiyo warns of destruction, and then he's not so sure whether it's really going to play itself out the way he thought. You see, Yonah, same thing. He wasn't sure how it would play itself out. And you see this a few times in Tanakh. So if the prophet who saw the prophecy and gave over the prophecy wasn't always confident how Hashem wants to play it out, certainly by us that way. And you could say more than that. Ibn Ezra writes, we discussed many times, that every prophecy has multiple interpretations. So it's not like the Ribbono Shel Olam said it, and this is the way it's going to play itself out. Even from the Ribbono Shel Olam's angle, so to speak, it's not defined yet how it's going to play itself out, because Hashem says, it's up to you. The whole point of the prophecy is so that people take heed. Well, if people do take heed, then the prophecy plays itself out differently. So that's the idea that Ibn Ezra says about a bris, that a bris is a covenant, is a way of locking in an agreement, so to speak. Because otherwise, prophecies have so many different interpretations that are valid that you can't even know. Just because Hashem said it doesn't mean we know exactly how it's going to be. Yeah? So that's why I'm very scared when people look at the Nevi'im and say, this is a fulfillment of the Nevuah. How does he know? You know, the Nevi'im themselves weren't always sure. So I don't see how we could be confident. It's encouraging to see that many of the promises about what would happen when we come back to Eretz Yisrael seem to be fulfilling themselves. But there are still certain things that haven't happened yet. So that's why I don't think it's right to work off of the Nevi'im and look at current events and say, you see, what's going to happen next is this, that, and other thing.
So and, based on the current events that are happening in this part of the world and around the world, do we have any indication or speculation as to what it's leading to?
Yeah, I want to quote to you speculation of what it's leading to, and after the quote I'll tell you who said it, okay? Ve'ein safek, and undoubtedly what we're witnessing now with all the Arab countries, is the fulfillment of the prophecies about Chevlo Shel Mashiach, the birth pangs of the Messiah. This was said by Maimonides almost 1,000 years ago. When Maimonides witnessed what was going on in the turmoil and the Mamluks and the different groups of fanatic Muslims that were coming in and destroying the Jewish heritage in the Muslim countries, the Rambam was super confident. He writes it in his letter to the Taimanim, i.e. Niger Taiman. There's no question, he says, that these are the birth pangs of Mashiach. It's been 1,000 years. I don't know if the Rambam thought that it would take 1,000 years for Mashiach to come. I don't think so. So that's why I'm saying I'd be very careful. And the same thing, a similar idea was written by Rav Sadia Gaon. So that's why I wouldn't put any.
Do you have any kind of better viewpoint to this than they did? Like the establishment of Israel is like, you know, that's like we're closer than.
I could quote to you Sfarim.
To perceive this than they did. The Ramban, I think, said that the closer you are, the more easy it is to perceive the end or something. And so then could we use that principle and say, yeah, you know, but the state of Israel is like a defining moment in Jewish history.
We hope it will be. We hope. Rav Kook wrote that when the people are sent to Israel, it can go in one of two ways. Either it can be a source of great spiritual growth, and that will lead to great physical growth. Or if we don't ensure that spiritually the country grows, then the country will self-destruct. So that's Rav Kook, who had the vision that it's headed in the right direction, but he said it's up to us to keep it that way. So I'm saying, who could say? How do we know? I'm saying we.
And then we have in the Gemara that the sign first that the shoots give forth the fruit and branches and the mountains, you know, Israel blossoms, and this is a sign of the imminence of the redemption. So.
Okay.
We hope
it is. But if you look closely, it's not so clear that they didn't have that directly following the destruction of the Second Temple too. Remember, Rabbi Akiva was sure that Bar Kokhba was going to be the Mashiach. And the Rambam writes he erred. And the Rambam also thought he was on the brink of Mashiach, and he erred. And Rashi in his commentary on Daniel also thought Mashiach was around the corner. And Rashi writes that if the date will pass, then I erred. So I don't know that we're that much smarter than they were. We'd like to think it, and I agree with you, there are certain gemarot that certainly support it. Now it's our job to make it a reality. It won't happen on its own. It's our job to ensure that the spirit permeates the building that's going on here. No, I told you, the spirit. Having lots of kids might not be the answer, because if you have so many kids that you can't educate them and they end up growing wild and they end up being terrorists, I'm not sure you did society a favor. I'm not sure those are the kids that are going to move Am Yisrael forward.
Is not to have a time like Yirmiyahu talk about 70 years?
So the 70 years, the simple reading of those 70 years is that it was between the first and second temple. Not now.
Yeah, I agree, but so now maybe we have the same written somewhere.
We have in the prophecies of Daniel, prophecies that explain when it's going to come, and in the Torah.
It's getting crazy when every day, 1,200 something. So
right.
Start to finish.
But yeah, right. Yeah, that's what the angel told him, hide it. But some of the commentaries writing on the Psukim in Daniel and in the Psukim in Eicha, there's a commentary called the Ibn Yechia, and he wrote that in the beginning of the years, 5,700, meaning that's when Israel will redeclare their Eretz Yisrael as their homeland. They will come back and reestablish themselves here. Mm-hmm. So he wrote that in his commentary. There's another work by the father or the grandfather of the Chida on the Torah, where he also writes down, working off of the Psukim of Yaakov's blessings, where Yaakov says, gather and I will tell you. Working with those words, he also pinpoints the years of the declaration of the state, and he says that's when Am Yisrael will return to Eretz Yisrael. But you know what? For every commentary you find that hit that year, you have many, many more who didn't, and big people. Rashi, Rav Sadigon, Rambam. So it's nice to think that. We hope it'll be that. What?
Who are these two, though, that actually did?
One was the Ibn Yechya. We have his commentary on Tanakh. And the other was the grandfather of the Chida. I'm pretty sure it's the grandfather. If you remind me, I have a copy of it in the yeshiva in Ketamon.
Yeah, because he mentioned away 48.
I don't remember how close he is, but it's like within.
In the wake of all of everything that's going on with the neighboring countries, with the Arabs here, with the Jews, Jewish, the way like Jewish society is evolving within Israel, within the Kutsar, in everything. What's the proper thing to do? What? We don't have control over like what's going on in Syria or anything. You know, maybe the army has control over the way they might react to weapons being sent from here to there, but what, as us Jewish civilians in Israel who, with Hashem's help, have a future ahead and things to do right now, what should that be, given the amount of control and influence that we have?
So give me 1 second. Reuben, could I pour you a drink? And would you like a slice of pizza? No. Okay. So, Chazal say there's a distinction between Nevi'ei Umot HaOlam and Nevi'ei Yisrael. That when you look at the prophets of the world, they rejoiced at the downfall of Israel. You see, in Bilam, he looked for how to curse us. Whereas the Nevi'ei Yisrael, like Yeshaya, they weren't happy when they saw destruction happening in the world. Yeshaya weeps over it. Numerous times in his prophecy, he expresses his pain at the suffering of the nations. I don't think we're supposed to be happy. Oh, great, all these innocent civilians are getting killed. Yes, there are many terrorists up there. There are also some civilians. Not everyone there is a terrorist. And I think that we are being given a gift, meaning about 4 years ago, there was a lot of discussion that with all the peace plans they were talking about, they said the United States was pushing these peace plans, and there was a real fear that Obama would push them and then start selling weapons to Syria and Lebanon and Egypt and Jordan. And now Egypt is barely doing anything. I don't think that anyone views them as too much of a threat, even though they do have the most advanced weapons right now. And Syria is self-destructing, and Lebanon is in threat of self-destructing, and Jordan has a lot of protests that the media doesn't get to cover, and no one knows what's going on there either. So no one's thinking that they're a threat.
They just worry about what's going on in Israel.
So I'm saying there was definitely a gift from above that was given us, because they're cleaning themselves out. Yeah, you have a situation where in Beirut, the Hezbollah was fired on. I'm saying, so you have, we didn't fire, the rebels from Syria fired on them. So two missiles, a day or two ago. So we're being given a gift from above, where Chazal say that when Rishayim fight one another, that's a blessing to the world. They're busy fighting one another. So here you have Hezbollah and Hamas fighting. You have Iran and Syria. You have forces that threaten us, and they're destroying one another. So it's definitely a gift, and we have to say thank you for it. You know, whenever the Ribbono Shel Olam gives us something good, we have to say thank you. At the same time, we have to dominate, should work out right. Look, when Libya fell down, so there were a lot of anti-aircraft missiles. Very quietly, the Israeli government changed three of the airplanes, meaning three of the airline companies in Israel have missile defense systems on them. When you fly a plane of El Al, your plane is equipped with missile defense. Because in Libya, they saw that they had, I think, 30,000 land-to-air missiles that launchers that were that load on the shoulders that disappeared, and officially no one knows where they are. I wouldn't be surprised if they're sitting in a warehouse in Tel Aviv, but officially no one knows where they are. Right? I'm not sure that the United States and Israel don't know where they are. I don't know. But at the end of the day, I'm saying we have to damn that it works out right. You see, the state of Israel isn't getting involved to some degree because we don't know what's good for us. Meaning, who said that the regime that will take over for us that is better for us? We don't know that. And the same is true in Jordan, and the same is true in Egypt. So I think we have a lot to daven for. Personally, when the revolt started in Egypt, I used to daven a lot over what's going on in Egypt, because I saw it as a tremendous potential danger for us. The Muslim Brotherhood were partners with the Nazis. I'm saying the Muslim Brotherhood that went up there were partners with the Nazis during World War II.
Did they exist back then?
Yeah.
Same group?
Yeah.
Nasser was from the Muslim Brotherhood, and Nasser was buddy-buddy with Hitler. And, when Nasser became Prime Minister of Egypt, he killed out everyone else, and he outlawed the Muslim Brotherhood. To ensure his power, he took those steps. But, so they went underground.
So pretty much in addition to davening that it's Hashem's, that it's Hashem's hands coordinating all of this, and despite the fact that we might not be able to fully pinpoint what's going on and where and what it's all leading to not only trust that it is Hashem doing it, but to pray to Him that He's doing it for the best, while in the meantime, we, living here in Israel, continue to live our lives, raise children who are to be righteous, God-fearing Jews, and carry on the mission, go to the army if we're able to, and do everything we can in order to strengthen ourselves.
We keep growing.
It might happen.
Yeah, that's our job. What choice do we have? So I think it is right to daven over.
So not to be obsessed over like the outbreak of a world war possibility.
No, and there's not that much you can do. Saying there are forces that are beyond your control. So things that are beyond your control. That's where it's very comforting to be a ma'amin. I say that I don't know how people who don't believe in Hashem go to sleep at night. You don't have control over your health. You don't have control over what's going on in the world. You don't have control over your family's health. How do you sleep at night? There are so many potential hazards in this world that we have no control over. So if you say there's a Ribbono Shel Olam guiding the world, I understand how you could sleep at night. But if there is no Ribbono Shel Olam guiding the world, so then there's a lot to worry about. A person can really fret over a lot of real threats that exist in the world. When there's a Ribbono Shel Olam, so you say, okay, I did mine, now he'll do his. Well, and it's not my thought, this is the Kuzer. The Kuzer, he says this idea too. This is one of the benefits of the system, is that you know what the Ribbono Shel Olam wants of you, and you could go to sleep at night. Which, by the way, is an answer to people who think Judaism is OCD. Yeah? People think that in Judaism, did I make a bracha, didn't I make a bracha? Obsessive compulsive disorder. So people think everything in Judaism you should be compulsive about. Obsessive. Maybe, are my tefillin in the middle? Maybe not. Maybe yeah. Maybe not. Did I say that bracha with enough kavanah? But maybe now I should drink more. But maybe I'm only drinking because I want it. Maybe it's not l'shem shamayim. Maybe the Ribbono Shel Olam is upset with me. No. So you guys are laughing. I think it's one of the blessings of what the Torah gives us. There's a limited, defined amount of expectations. And a person's supposed to be able to say, I did it. You see, the Torah gives us a mitzvah. Vidui Maestros, right? You're supposed to come to the temple and say, Ribbono Shel Olam, you gave me a bunch of mitzvahs to do, these fruits and vegetables, to take off the tithe, to take off the truma. I did what you told me. Now, how many people today will ever say, I did what you told me? Maybe I didn't have enough kavanah when I made the blessing of it. Maybe I should have taken one more kernel off. See, that's not Judaism. You see, the Torah gave you a biblical mitzvah to declare, I did it. This is what you wanted. I did it. Now, it takes a certain balanced approach that is sometimes hard to attain, because we know two venues. We know two directions in today's world. Either 100%, with the internet and everything, we know everything's 100%. Today you know exactly where the bus is when you go to the bus stop. Right? You guys know they have this program on your cell phone where you can know exactly where the bus is right now. So everything's exact in our lives. So we want to think that Judaism is also exact. No. No. When Hashem says to put the tefillin in the middle of your head, he didn't say get a mirror. I'm serious. I'm serious. It's a new thought for most people. Most people think, if it's supposed to be in the middle, let me... should be exactly right. I saw many times, I was in yeshivas where you saw the students going to the Rosh Yeshiva. Like the Rosh Yeshiva would be sitting there trying to daven, and students would be telling him, you got to move your tefillin. And the Rosh Yeshiva is always this modest person, so they tell me, shift it. And then another student goes like this, and that's when the Rosh Yeshiva buries his head in the sitter.
Someone got me a mirror, so I look at it every morning. And then every once in a while, someone looks at me and goes, it has to move over a little.
Maybe the mirror is not good.
I recall from years back reading about some type of machlokas between, I think it was a Rambam and someone else, about all the details of the mitzvah. So, for example, whether you have 8 strings in your tzitzis or 6 or 10, so like nowadays we have all these beautiful lessons which we learn about dafka 8 strings and represents this and that, but that whether or not the mitzvahs were given because there's some underlying logic behind it or because something had to be chosen. So it could have been 4, 6, 8, or 20. So Hashem, so to speak, chose something out of a hat and okay, it was 8. Or for the lulav, it had to be 3. Could you maybe expound this a bit or with the two sides of the machlokes?
Okay, so that's a,